Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Tuesday, the 4th of August. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We're delighted you are with us to spend time here in this digital space where we can talk about what is happening in our world. We have wonderful, wonderful people to do so, and we welcome you to join in on the conversation. To do that, all you have to do is email us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. WAMC's Alan Shartok in the house. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Hi, Joe. A couple of things. First of all, I want to join with you in welcoming Ray back.
Because Ray's back.
All is well in the world. Ray is back.
Yes.
That's terrific.
Yes.
That's wonderful. Secondly, I came back from my 4-mile walk in the rain, and as I was coming in the house, there on the lawn was a magnificent doe, what I think was a newborn baby, lying right next to them on our lawn. I mean, it was
so
really
sweet.
And did not move. It was really quite something.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, and it was, so that made it a spectacular morning so far, and now it'll get even better.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Nothing will go up and up. We also welcome former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain to the program. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. I also took a walk with my wife this morning, but nothing compares to your arrival home today, Alan.
Yeah.
To see the fawn and the mom.
Yeah.
No fawn here.
Fawn. Yes, that's what I meant, fawn.
All right. We also go to our good friend, investigative journalist and New Albany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary.
Hello. No walks, no fawns. I'm eating cheese doodles for breakfast. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Doodles.
We're doing good, and I must say I'm a little jealous. That's great. The cheese doodles sound good. And we also welcome the Empire Report's J.P. Miller to the program. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you, Joe?
We're well. Very nice to have you here. We always love when you're on our program. Anything you want to share? Anything newsworthy? Anything interesting?
Well, I did want to note that, you know, it's always sunnier in the morning when you have Ray Graff around. So I'm feeling it. I hope everyone else is feeling it.
Oh, we're all feeling it. You feel it when I parked the car and I was walking in the building. There was just like a halo over the building.
Yeah.
It's that Ray optimism.
A ray of optimism.
That's absolutely right. All right. Good morning, everybody. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. Let's get started and talk about the news of the day. So, you know, if you're Dr. Fauci and you've been pushed around and sort of left out to dry a couple times, and then all of a sudden you have someone to commiserate with in the with Dr. Birx now, that after months of favor, Dr. Birx raised Trump's ire with a grim coronavirus assessment that she gave on CNN and Jake Tapper's program, although I believe it was not hosted by him this
Dana
week. Dana Bash, right. So she went on and said that it was that things were bad. And then the president took to Twitter yesterday and I believe called her pathetic. But then went on to basically blame it all on Nancy Pelosi. So Birx, who built a career leading public health efforts against HIV and AIDS, quickly garnered Trump's favor earlier this year for publicly championing the administration's coronavirus response, becoming a prominent figure both inside and outside the White House. But she soon lost support within swaths of the scientific and medical community for seeming to minimize the virus and to enable Trump's overly rosy view of the pandemic. This past weekend, Birx lost the backing of the nation's top Democrat, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who privately called Birx, quote, the worst, and publicly said she had no confidence in her. And finally, on Monday morning, Birx appeared to lose ground with her with perhaps her most important constituency, Trump himself, who dismissed her as pathetic. The tweet went like this. So, crazy Nancy Pelosi said horrible things about Dr. Deborah Birx, going after her because she was too positive on the very good job we were doing on combating the China virus, including vaccines and therapeutics. In order to counter Nancy, Deborah took the bait and hit us pathetic. Trump was referring to Birx's assessment, grim assessment, Sunday on CNN's State of the Nation, State of the Union, in which she described the coronavirus as extraordinarily widespread across the nation and warned that the deadly contagion has infiltrated both rural and urban areas. In the interview, she also did not rule out the possibility that the nation's coronavirus death toll could double by the end of the year to 300,000, and seemed to suggest that, contrary to the president's stated desires, that some schools should offer only distance learning this fall. Apparently, Trump was especially incensed that she did not strike a more optimistic tone about states that are doing well. And by her praise for Pelosi, an ardent Trump critic said one senior administration official who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity. When asked about Pelosi's lack of confidence in the handling of the pandemic, Birx replied, "I have tremendous respect for the speaker, and I have tremendous respect for her long dedication to the American people." Meanwhile, Dr. Fauci defended Birx's statement yesterday, pointing to insidious community spread. All right, so that is the setup of the days of our lives that is the health officials in this country dealing with the President of the United States. Alan.
Well, I'm going to give tremendous credit to Birx for the way she has handled this. Obviously, she felt very badly about the criticism that she got from Pelosi. But instead of striking out at Pelosi, she went the other direction. She talked about how much she admired Pelosi. And I have to say, that is rare. You know, usually get up your dukes and then somebody's going to fight with somebody else. But she was quite clear. She also has made it clear that she's not happy about the criticism. She's sad about the criticism that she's had from the president. These are Fauci and Birx are obviously people who are the chief scientists in all of this, unlike, the pathetic vice president who mirrors whatever Trump says. These are the people on that task force who have been upfront about it and you got to give a lot of credit to Fauci for supporting Birx in all of this because, up to now, he's carried much of the water, much of the weight. And now he hasn't done that. I get to thinking about chickens a lot, and so the thing that comes across about the president is he's such a plucking liar.
Oh, wow. That's not where I thought you were going to go. I thought this was going to end up with a coming home to roost thing, but no. All right.
That too.
Plucking is where we're going here. Okay. Yes. It's hard to disagree. Rosemary, I'll let you follow that up.
I have no trouble disagreeing. I think that Deborah Birx deserves a criticism from Nancy Pelosi and should have anticipated what was going to happen the minute she decided to state reality instead of to just nod and lick the president's butt. And she has contributed to a terrible
What has this show become this morning? Go ahead.
She has contributed to a confusing and dangerous mixed message in this country about coronavirus. And there's no way around it. And that's why Pelosi lacks confidence in her. She has said the president was intelligent. For that alone, I think she should be impeached. She has said that, the president was just thinking aloud, but the idea of a disinfectant, ingest it, there could be something to it. Come on. And Fauci, I'm glad he stood up to, of course he did. I think he is, he's figured out his voice. I've had criticism much the same of him up to now. He also gives only mild, very mild, an indirect criticism of the president. He never says outright, this is a bad message, we have to change it. He's still optimistic, but he wasn't the Pollyanna that she was. I love that the Robert Kennedy Foundation is giving him a Heroes Award, along with Colin Kaepernick. Great.
Wait.
Kind of a finger. You just
got through.
Kind of a finger in the face. The Robert Kennedy Award. He's what?
You just got through criticizing Fauci, which I think is reprehensible, to be honest with you, although I love you.
Did you not hear me say that I have been critical of him in the past, and I still think that he could have done better, but I'm coming around because he continues to be true to the idea that this is really dangerous. Yeah, we can still fix it, but it's really dangerous. He's much different than he was when we first started having this discussion.
I don't think so. I think he's always been stand up, and I think he's stand up now, and I think the American people believe it, and his polling numbers are huge. People think he's terrific. So do I, and I think I stand up for him. I also think that I don't disagree with you about where she was in the beginning. I think she was not stand up enough. She sat there. She took it. She didn't make the protestation she should have. So I agree with you. We're not really in disagreement about that. But I also think in this latest round, she showed some guts. I think that's great.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that she had chosen a different path than Fauci. She was kind of like the good cop, and he was maybe the bad cop. They had given her a small office in the West Wing, and you know, there'd been reports that you'd see her out in the hallway talking to top aides to Trump, like Jared Kushner, kind of bending their ear. And they kind of liked her because she did spin positively from the data that others were seeing with a lot more, danger. And they liked her, and she also had this ability to talk to Trump. She's politically astute. She could explain in very simple terms that he could understand what was going on, and used that, or tried to use that, to persuade him to do what was right. And I think her intentions were valid. She tried to work from within, and I think it really backfired. Her critics are all across the public health sector, and I think they're legitimate critics. Criticisms. They say she ignored evidence that was there. She said things that ended up not really being true. And maybe Nancy Pelosi, I agree, Rosemary, maybe Nancy Pelosi's words kind of just were the moment for her to say, you know, this is bigger than Trump and I'm not going to have any more influence over him. I better start telling the truth, which might be good because she was liked by the Fox News crew and yeah. Christian Broadcasting had her on. You know, so by having someone with her, at least credibility to that audience, now saying what she said on Sunday might actually shake some people who have been, you know, firm and not facing reality. So maybe by saving it till now, it has more impact, possibly.
And that, Michael, is why we love having you on the show. That was a brilliant analysis. Really great.
Thanks.
You are brilliant, Mike.
Oh, wow. I want to hear what JP has to say about this.
JP.
We've taken all the words up, JP.
JP, you well, talk about how brilliant Mike is, okay?
Mike is brilliant. That's why I'm excited to be on Tuesdays with Mike. But, I think Fauci and Birx are obviously smart people, but I think that they deserve some criticism. You know, the president's handling of this has been a disaster. It's going to be his legacy of how poorly he's mishandled the virus. But they are his two top advisors on how to handle the virus. Why have they not demanded, Fauci and Birx, why have they not demanded a national mask mandate? Why have they not demanded, you know, testing mobilization? We're here now 6 months after the virus started, and what is the strategy? No one can tell us what the national strategy is to combat the virus. It's basically, let's wait for the vaccine. Well, when is the vaccine coming? We don't know. Will it come? When it comes, there's only going to be 50% of the people are going to take the vaccine. So Fauci and Birx, I think, share blame with Trump. Obviously, he's in charge, and he's going to have the most blame, and that's going to be his legacy. But for them to be his two top advisors, I don't see – they're great at telling us, oh, there's going to be 300,000 deaths. Okay, well, what should we do about that?
Well, wait a second now.
Now, that was a more brilliant analysis.
Well,
better than Mike.
You're all brilliant.
Well. But the thing about Fauci, JP, is that, or And I was talking to your cousin PJ about it. The thing about Fauci is he did say to wear a mask from the very beginning. So when you say somebody should have said it, he did say that. And he got in the president's face about that. And the news media made a big thing out of it. You know, Rosemary and I will duke this out to the end. And that is it better that he was an insider? If he wasn't there, who would have been? I don't think any of us really disagree on her shortcomings on this, but he really was there from the very beginning, and he did say the things that had to be said, and if he wasn't there, we would have all been poorer for it.
I don't know. We're here now, how many months into this, and we've got, you know, right. Deaths spiking in California, deaths spiking in Texas, deaths right. spiking in Florida, and you would think that after New York suffered 32,000 deaths, more deaths than anywhere else in the country, that these other states would, you know, learn from this, and our federal government would learn from this and create some kind of strategy. No one can tell us what the national strategy is to combat the virus, because there is no national strategy.
Well, you're
there
right.
There is no state strategy.
You're right. The problem is that the guy at the head is a madman. No two ways about it. We are in this terrible situation. We have this panic, this terrible thing that's going on. And Fauci has been the stand-up guy about it. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and listen to you guys talk to me about he could have done more. I think he did an awful lot, and anybody could have done more, but not with this president, not with this madman.
All right, we have to take a break. We are very late, so let's do that. We'll be right back. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll return after this BBC News. Just want to mention that we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And please use that address, not others. That would be great. And that way we'll make sure that we get them. Panel at WAMC.org. All right. Well, we do have a few letters. And Mary says, neither party is winning hearts and minds by bickering over relief packages while Americans are being evicted and mourning lost loved ones. Sean says, can anyone address what exactly that the Republicans elected members of Congress have achieved with 4 years of this catastrophe? Why would they want 4 more years of this? Is the support really worth the potential of 200,000 Americans dead, a ruined economy, and a lost citizenry? Question mark. Anyone?
Well. Here's the microphone. Well, here it is.
I'm going to Velcro it to you.
Hello,
yes.
Microphone. the Republicans are certainly between the classic, I'm not even going to say rock and a hard place, a boulder and a cliff and a rock and a hard place. I mean, what are they going to do? They're facing a wipeout, no question. All the polls are showing them, not only the president, but the followers of the president, in tough shape. In his own state of Kentucky, the most powerful man in the United States Senate is virtually running neck and neck with a Democratic opponent in a Republican state. So they don't know where to go. What would you do, anybody on the panel? What would you do if you were a Republican right now? Stand up and say, okay, it's time to be a profile in courage. I want my kids to be proud of me. This president is a nut. And I'm going to say so, and then lose your election. That's a tough one.
Rosemary,
I think I agree with Alan on this. Yeah, I don't have. I think I do. Wow, Alan, that hardly ever happens, does it?
Don't let it happen again.
Okay.
Oscar says Fauci did not say to wear a mask from the beginning. He stated they would help so as not to lose PPE for the medical profession. That is one of the criticisms the president lays on Fauci often. In fact, most of those criticisms take place very early in the pandemic, in
that's right.
January and February. Nicholas says JP and Rosemary are correct. Fauci and Birx both should have been more firm and could have done more, even if it meant resigning in a big show. We go to
Go ahead. I was just going to say JP had it absolutely right. It was their job to create the national strategy. That there is not a national strategy still, 6 months into this crisis, means they did not do their job well. That's really hard to argue any other way. And also, as far as working with
Trump,
not
for me.
Boy, there was no big secret that that's how he was. You know, there's lots of evidence that if you sign on to work for the Trump administration, that's what you're getting. So,
well, he was there long before.
Absolutely, Mike.
I don't know.
Go ahead.
He wasn't given the reins on this. He was just the advisor to people who had to make the decisions, and they were politicians, and they ignored a lot of his advice. I mean, they probably ignored Deborah Birx's advice too. And the only national policy, you said it before, Rosemary, is that we're hoping for a vaccine that will come out by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's problematic. The fact that as an advisor to the president, you can present him with facts, you can present him with ideas of what to do, you can spell it all out for him. But if he doesn't do them, I don't know what else you can do other than express your opinion, which Fauci has done.
His job, I think Fauci's job for the last 40 years is to prepare the United States in the event of a big pandemic. And, you know, I think it's everybody can tell you how well he's done in terms of that. And obviously the president has been horrible and a disaster, but there are a few instances where you can say, well, Fauci said we should have done this and the president went the other way. And that would have made things better. You know, Fauci at one time, I'm old enough to remember when Fauci said, we may have 100,000 deaths from this virus. That was, I think, 3 or 4 months ago. We now have 150,000 deaths. They're now saying 300,000 deaths.
Yeah, but you can't lay that just on Fauci. I mean, the president and this administration just gave up. I mean, and we reopened too soon. And I don't know. Is that fair?
The president is totally responsible, but Fauci and Birx are his top advisors. It's their job to put together a strategy. What is their strategy? Where are they differing from him? Has Fauci come out and said we should have a national mask mandate? No. You know, has he come out and put forth a plan of this should be our national testing policy where we should ramp up testing? No.
But it seems...
Oh, he has too. I mean, testing is the thing he has called for from the very beginning. And he's been highly critical of the administration and of governments in general of not being able to muster enough equipment and chemicals needed for the testing. I mean, he's the champion of testing, and it hasn't happened. I don't know how you can blame him when he advises the right thing to do. And he advises... But the people making the decisions and the people getting Trump's ear are political advisors like Jared Kushner and Mark Meadows and his predecessors. And those are the people making the decisions. And that's where the problem is. It became political decisions, not public health decisions.
And at any time, just as evidenced by the interview this weekend, any time that either of these individuals, Dr. Birx or Dr. Fauci, turn around and say that things are really bad, they're called pathetic. I don't know how
and
you...
Punished.
Yeah, and punished.
They're sidelined, right. Because Fauci all along has said things that contradict the president. Don't bring him on the stage. Tell him he can't be on the television. And all of that has happened. And by the way, I'm so sorry for all the naysayers. There's no question that in the beginning he was caught between playing Saluji between the two, between the president and saying the right stuff. But he did say the right stuff. He did talk about masks. And then on occasion, he may have modified it a little bit or earlier, but he certainly did do it.
For those of you just joining us, Saluji is a keep-away game in which kids throw around an object with the aim of keeping it away from a particular person.
I've never heard that before, keep-away. I like it.
Yeah, I just want to, just in case people are just joining us and not aware of what Saluji was.
We play that here at WAMC, too, keep-away.
Keep-away. That's very fun. I do it with a puppy, actually. Rosemary, you were going to say?
Let's see. I don't know. I think you have a list. I'm hammering away at the same point. I mean, if your job is to stop the country from being going down a horrible, deadly rabbit hole of a disease.
Let me just ask it this way, Rosemary, and maybe this will just to focus all of us. But can you imagine anyone doing a better job? Meaning, to be able to have an effect on this president to change our course.
Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I think Nancy Pelosi could too. However,
no, I mean in the health group. Yeah. In the health position, in those positions.
No, I don't have a list of 18 top epidemiologists who I would pick.
No,
obviously,
but what I'm
not.
Saying is you have the best, and I'm wondering, like...
The CDC could have handled this, and instead, Fauci and Burge have sat by, in a way, as they've watched Trump degrade not just them and their expertise, but the agency set up to handle this very thing. That's a huge problem. It's even bigger in a way than the disease that we're in the middle of right now. That eventually, I guess, something will happen. Thousands more are going to die needlessly. But after that, the next disease that comes along, is it going to be any better? Are we dependent on the political strengths and weaknesses of whoever is president then to solve this? No. We're not. And the graph that's coming out, now we're finding out that it's a private agency that has been retained by the government to collect the data, the health data that used to go to the CDC. Why aren't Birch and all the doctors on this? Redfield, too, I would include. Why aren't they screaming about this and saying, protect the CDC? It's like when the Weathers administration was under attack because they came out with a prediction, accurate prediction, that Trump didn't like and took out a Sharpie, and he denigrated them. And they let it happen. And that's
what do you mean they let it happen? What were the choices? How could they do that? Hey, and by the way, your praise for the CDC and its effectiveness, let me tell you, that guy, Redfield, is that his name? Redfield,
yes.
Sitting at the top.
Yeah.
His face was up there every time, and I didn't see him taking the president to task. I think Fauci was the hero.
Didn't I say I would add Redfield to that, too? It isn't just Birch and Fauci. No one has effectively countered him, even though they have the expertise.
But you're the one who said the CDC should have been doing this. Well, the CDC is headed by a person, too, and he did a lousy job.
Yeah, I think all three have done a lousy job. That what they might have done instead of deciding whether to kiss up or to talk back to the president would have been to say, we have an agency set up to do it. Here it is. Let's put our attention here. Let's give them more funding. We have none of that. There's no tools to get extra money, for example.
But you're not telling us.
And at the meantime.
But you're not telling us that Fauci. You're not telling us that Fauci was kissing up to the president. I mean, 10,000 reporters and political analysts and everybody else can't be wrong. He had his life in his hands, and he had great courage. I hate to see you trashing Fauci, Rosemary. I really do.
I would like to like him. I am happy that he's getting the award from the Kennedy Foundation. I don't think what he's doing is without difficulty, and he's undoubtedly doing the best he can. But he's not criticized Trump very directly or very hard. He has contradicted him on science, but he's done it in the gentlest of ways. I'm listening to him talk now about opening schools, and he's not saying, this is a crazy idea. Kids are going to be dying in the street. He's saying, well, we can do it. We have to test more. We have to be really careful. Come on. No.
All right.
That's another whole story.
Diane wrote to us and said, please change the subject. So we're going to do that.
Thanks, Diane. We wouldn't have come to it without you.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll move on to other subjects as well. We have a bunch of them. We'll do that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. Donald Trump says he's examining executive orders on evictions, payroll taxes, if he can't reach a deal with the Democrats. The comments come as negotiations continue on Capitol Hill, but the parties are far apart. The president said that he's looking at unilaterally taking steps to stop tenant evictions and lower payroll taxes, adding that such moves might be necessary if a new coronavirus relief bill can't be brokered with congressional Democrats. A lot of people are going to be evicted, but I'm going to stop it because I'll do it myself if I have to, Trump told reporters in an event at the White House. I have a lot of powers with respect to executive orders, and we're looking at that very seriously right now. He later said he could act to prevent people from having to go to homeless shelters, where he said they could be at higher risk of catching the coronavirus. They are thrown out viciously, Trump said. It's not their fault. Similarly, he told reporters he could use an executive order to lower payroll taxes after the idea generated little enthusiasm on Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, the debate still goes on. Jobless aid has expired, and the president, as his top advisors, met with Democratic leaders to try to hash out a compromise. The president is hurling insults at Democrats and mused aloud about short-circuiting the talks and acting on his own, as we just said, but he wants to be more on the sidelines. But meanwhile, not much work being done. Mr. Trump called Speaker Pelosi Crazy Nancy, charging that she had no interest in helping the unemployed. He said Senator Chuck Schumer of New York only wanted to help the radical left governors in states run by Democrats, and he threatened to short-circuit a delicate series of negotiations to produce a compromise and instead unilaterally impose a federal moratorium on tenant evictions. The comments came just as Mr. Trump's own advisors were on Capitol Hill meeting with Pelosi and Schumer in search of an elusive deal, and they underscored just how absent the president had been from those negotiations. Alan.
If anybody thinks that Donald Trump is setting aside and not playing a role, they just don't know the history of the art of the deal and of Donald Trump. What he does is he says this, but he's calling in the plays, obviously, and at the last moment, he's going to come in and say, I don't like what you did. He's done that before. His own daughter talked about that and how he has conducted himself during these kinds of deals or negotiations that he gets into. So it's a bunch of baloney. It's everything else he's been saying is 20,000 lies, as the Washington Post on this. And, he thinks he's got the Democrats where it hurts. And he will not, because he doesn't have any kind of empathy, he will not get off the dime and make an agreement.
Rosemary?
It isn't just Trump, too. It's the whole Republican Party that is just finds repugnant the idea of helping people who need it. A new study out shows that it is not true that the extra $600 a week has kept people from going back to work or looking for new work. It just simply is not true. It's a Republican idea that people want to be on the take. It's like the welfare queen idea all over again, and it's racist and repugnant. So it's way more than Trump. And I also point out that he again is pressing, after everyone else, bipartisan, has dropped the idea of a payroll tax drop. He's back at that and now talking about doing it on his own. This is a direct attack on Social Security. Please be afraid. Be very afraid.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, so far, I'd be curious what you guys think. So far, the Democrats seem to have been able to hold steady here on their $3 trillion package. I think they see it as their last, and it is, it's their last shot for the rest of this year to get any kind of relief package pushed through. And the pain and the unemployment and the devastation economically that is just building in this country and continues to build, this is the chance to do something to mitigate that. And I think they have the upper hand, but if they don't, it could flip the other way if this pain continues and no relief happens. And that's clearly what the Republicans are trying to do. It seems like Trump would be happy to approve all of it, because he wants it politically, but the Republicans are exactly as you say, Rosemary. Mark Meadows is kind of leading the charge for the Republicans on this, and he comes from a Tea Party background. He's a champion in the Tea Party, And they do want to get rid of Social Security entitlements and Medicare entitlements, where those payroll taxes go. So, you know, there's all kinds of, conflicting agendas here. The Democrats seem united while everyone else seems to be at odds. But if something doesn't happen soon, the pain is going to, everybody's just going to be suffering. And what's going to happen? I don't know.
JP.
It is a tough negotiation, because I do think that the Democrats, as you guys have said, are holding all the cards here. Trump has no leverage over trying to get them to change the package, and they want a strong package, and they're not going to lower it. And what you have to remember is that if nothing happens, you know, they benefit. It hurts Trump more than anybody, because he will be seen as not being able to get a deal done. He's harsh, and he's not willing to help people. And so if nothing gets done, the Democrats will benefit in November. The Republican senators do not want more spending. And so, yes, Trump is in a horrible place right here. And I do not think that if he does something by executive action, that it will be seen as a victory, and it won't be, obviously as comprehensive as what could be done if everybody got together from a legislative standpoint.
How do you see this ending, Alan? I mean, eventually, we've been talking for the last couple of weeks about this. The $600 has come and gone, and you just wonder when you get back to something for the people who need it.
Well, look, I don't think that the Democrats expect $3 trillion, in this thing. I've been saying, when the compromise comes, if Trump wants a compromise, the Democrats have a problem, Joe, and that is they want relief, but they want long-term relief that'll get them through November. And this guy, now Trump, is throwing them red meat and saying, "Okay, I'll give you the $600, but I won't give you anything else."
Right.
And they won't take that. So there's a compromise. The difference is that Trump doesn't give a damn about the way that people are hurting, whereas the Democrats obviously have a constituency that really needs help, and their hearts are with them. That's the problem.
Does anyone see the irony of Trump, almost comical irony of Trump, stepping in with an executive order to prevent evictions when his real estate companies have been especially tough on tenants and kicking people out and holding high bars in front of people of color for getting into their various properties? It's bizarro.
Yeah, so
nothing means anything with Trump. That's why he has the upper hand. Because if he tells so many lies and he just says, "I'm for them and I'll do this for them and I'll do that for them," he is just a lying liar. And that's it. That's the problem. The Democrats can't do that. There is still some credibility.
That's interesting, though, Mike. Why do you think he's even the eviction has become his issue?
It puzzles me that he would focus on that one. I mean, he's also looking at removing the payroll tax, which Rosemary, I think, hit it right on the nail. But the idea of preventing evictions, it's a good idea. And why can't that just be part of the relief bill? I mean, why can't that be one of if everyone agrees with it, why not just do it? Why make it an executive order? But see, it has to be part of a bigger package for this to go through. And it does play, as Alan said, it's a promise made to a constituency that says, "Oh, good, he's doing something for us," even though nothing happens.
JP?
I still find it hard to believe that something is going to be able to get passed legislatively. I don't see the interests of the Democrat legislators, the Democratic legislators, the Republican legislators, and Trump aligning here on this package. I think it, him sending up the smoke signal of, "Oh, maybe I'll do some executive order," I think that may be the way that it has to go. I do not see a package going through. I haven't seen any movement on it in a couple of weeks, and the benefits have already expired.
Rosemary, I think I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, you didn't cut me off, and my message is gloomy. I see death and deprivation ahead. I don't think there's going to be action except for something limited by an executive order, which, by the way, remember when Republicans thought the executive orders were a bad way to govern? Now,
yes,
it's
right.
The only way that's not done. But hypocrisy means nothing nowadays. So I think there'll be some limited actions, like throwing, like saying, okay, we'll have no evictions. Okay, that's a kind act. It will help many people stay in their homes. But look what it does to the economy. That means there's all kinds of homeowners, property owners who are unable to pay taxes, unable to pay bills to suppliers, unable to pay mortgages to banks. So it's like when you put your finger in it this way, in an unbalanced way, you're going to set off other problems and huge problems in an economy that he needs to be working much more smoothly than it is right now.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller are our panelists this morning. We'll continue our conversation after news from Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let's go to a couple of letters, and then we'll move on to other subjects. Jane writes to us and says, I'm happy that renters have some relief and protection during this pandemic, but our renter of our family home has not paid rent since last January, and we're in danger of losing the house because we can't pay the taxes. The renter received the bailout and the unemployment checks, but has not paid us anything. He's not responded to us for months. We cannot find any help at all. Please give us a suggestion. Well, I don't know that we have one, but it's I think it's a good thing to highlight of some of the unless I'm speaking for the panel. Does anyone have any help for Jane there?
Homeowners are human beings also. And people who own property and who depend on their living because they're renting it, you know, we can consider. However, there are a lot more people who, you know, who are in that, who are in a box who are as tenants than there are as homeowners. So you can see where the political will be.
Terry writes... Terry writes, Washington Post reports this morning Trump requests key money as part of the TikTok acquisition. We actually have that story on our list. Never heard the term, looked it up, commonly a bribe paid by tenant to induce landlord to rent. Wow, says Terry. Mike, you want to give us a quick update on the TikTok story? Of course, the president has threatened to shut TikTok down, and now there is Microsoft to the rescue?
Yeah, this is a really complicated story for people who don't use TikTok, and I'm not really a TikTok user, so I've been sort of reading about it with fascination. It's an extraordinarily popular app that a lot of young people use, and it is owned by a Chinese company, and there's been this belief that China has access to all this data on these young people in the U.S., and Trump has threatened to kick it out of the country, basically. And it now turns out that Microsoft wants to buy it, which is kind of comical because that's kind of an old man, a grandfatherly company in the tech business. And they want to become cool, I guess, by buying it. And Trump is pushing pressure on this Chinese company to sell, and Microsoft wants to buy it. So it almost looks like, you know, we're nationalizing or bringing, and he says that. He says, I want an American company to buy it. If they can't, we're going to close it down. I mean, to put pressure on a foreign-owned country so an American country can benefit from it does make me a little queasy. I like Microsoft. I think it's a great company. You know, they've done some weird things over the years, but I think that they own Minecraft, which is a young person's popular game, and this would add and help expand their access. It makes perfect business sense for them to do it, but to have Trump broker it and then to ask for money to go to the federal treasury and you know, as part of the deal, it just sounds like extortion. It to me, and I'm very uncomfortable with it.
Is it legal?
I don't know that it is. I mean, I mean, TikTok may be happy to get the revenue and just get the heck out, but TikTok is a worldwide platform. What's going to happen to the other countries, the people in other countries that use TikTok? Now, I guess Microsoft would buy it for New Zealand, Australia, and a couple of other countries too. But I mean, is it going to be a separate world? Or will people in Europe who use TikTok be able to get the Chinese people and also get the U.S. people? It's so complicated. I just don't.
JP?
Maybe JP. You're a young guy. Can you tell us?
Unfortunately, I don't have TikTok. Or maybe I should say, fortunately, I don't have TikTok. But, you know, Microsoft does, according to CNBC, have $136 billion in cash. So they should be able to acquire TikTok if they want to. And Trump getting in the middle of this, in my view, can't be because he is worried about policy. I think it's more of a political issue for him to try to demonize China ahead of the election. I don't think that he's truly worried about security. When these apps are downloaded on Apple and Android devices, Apple and Verizon have security features that TikTok has to get approved on. You know, they can't just put anything that they want on an Apple device. Apple's very, very stringent on what apps are put on the phone and what those apps can do and what data that those apps can collect.
Rosemary.
Okay, so I don't think Trump is completely wrong to be concerned about security. Hell, I'm concerned about security on Instagram, which is owned by an American company. So I don't think that that's untoward. It's not beyond the Chinese to use information collected from TikTok. So that said, I'm not opposed to his trying to get more American control over it. But what the heck is Microsoft paying money to the government for? It's not clear that he would only take money from the Treasury from TikTok or Brightbyte is the name of the parent company. It would come from Microsoft. Why is Microsoft willing to go along with that? It's perfectly capable of making a deal, one private equity firm with one in China. What is Trump involved at all for? And if they should go ahead, if Microsoft were to go ahead in the deal and then there somehow were some regulatory interference, that would be a lawsuit that I'm sure Microsoft could win. So I don't get what he's doing.
I mean,
I think he's just trying to be cute to stand up for and get money for the American people, America first.
I guess, but it's surreal to see him say that he expects to receive a chunk of a deal between two private companies that he, as Mike stated, exactly, is effectively forcing to alter. Right? I mean, it's weird.
Yeah, exactly. Why they don't need Trump. They can make the deals themselves.
Mike?
Yeah, I mean, no. I thought Trump represented free enterprise, you know, and the private sector being the private sector. It just sounds like a logical business deal for Microsoft to buy a smaller company that would expand its reach to younger people, which they need to do to continue to grow and put more money into that $136 billion fund that they have. But it's the way business works. Trump getting involved just makes him look good. Oh, I kept this in America. It was going to close, but I kept it in America, and you can thank me for that. Yeah, I think that's what's going on.
Megan brings up this point, and it is a point that often comes up in the articles about this, that Trump has a thing against TikTok because kids use the app to buy up tickets to his rally and not show in order to embarrass him with great success. That was the Tulsa rally, and that did seem to put TikTok on the on his radar. But as to this issue of getting money on top of it, it's somewhat hard to figure out. Anybody else on that? All right.
Well, it should be interesting if it would be Bill Gates versus Trump, right? Bill Gates has been quite an interesting opponent to Trump on coronavirus. So I'm looking forward. That's a battle of worthies.
Scott writes to us. This is all on the $600 and the aid package. Scott says, I don't know the last time any of the people speaking were in the position to hire someone at the minimum wage. I've worked in the intellectual developmentally disabled field for 20 years, starting as direct care. I've never seen the lack of applications for employment as we see now. Most of our workforce is entry-level direct care. We had employees quit to get unemployment because they made more. Maybe having someone who is in an HR professional who does hire entry-level positions would provide a real-life perspective.
Well, that gets into that whole debate about whether or not the $600 additional on top of state unemployment insurance, weekly unemployment insurance, is preventing people from going back to work, or are people not going back to work because they're afraid, or they have to stay home because their spouse has to work from home, or they, you know, all those complicated situations that come up. And yeah, are some people looking at it, the bottom line, and saying, I'm better off not going to work? I'm sure there's some of that, but how widespread is that? And it's a trope, just as Rosemary called it earlier. You know, it's just a trope that the poor people are cashing in, they're lazy, and they're not doing anything. And I think that's the risk of sort of letting that out there. While there may be some abuse, I think that people are hurting. And just getting back to the landlord who was very sympathetic, you know, and who wrote in, you know, it does not, the ending an eviction does not keep you from having to pay eventually your landlord. And that landlord does have recourse through the courts to go and get the money from their tenant. It's not easy. It's not complicated. It's not good. But it's the one thing that they can do, and that hasn't changed. You still owe the money to your landlord. You're just getting a break on when you have to pay them. So, I mean, it's not like these people are getting a free ride. That's all I'm saying.
I asked a question earlier of the rationale behind Trump embracing this issue. Susan has an answer, writing to us and saying, if people are evicted, they do not have an address to use for mail-in ballots. Ricky says, isn't preventing elections a kind of socialism? Russ says, the scale of the depression we are facing has only been dimly described in the media. We are looking at extended unemployment for 20 million people, many of whom may well fall into homelessness. Among those are undocumented aliens with no claim to government help. This would create a tragedy on the scale of the 1930s. The premature reopening of most states has ensured several months of continued lockdowns. Over the next 6 months, we will see a huge buildup of popular demand for relief. Alan, anything on that?
No. Everybody has a theory on why Trump is doing things, why, this guy is right or that person is wrong. But there's not much we can do about that except to express those ideas, right?
Right. Joel is taking us to task. Please stop referring to Social Security as an entitlement. We paid for it. It's our money. Successive Congresses have stolen from it repeatedly.
I just want to say that I did not call it an entitlement. I said that is the Tea Party rhetoric, that they want to take away entitlements that they regard as entitlements. If I suggested that I believe it's an entitlement, since we paid into it, just like the Medicare fund, we're paying into it with our paychecks, all our careers, it's not an entitlement. You paid for it. It's your insurance that you're getting back.
Yeah, so there.
Well, no, I maybe by using the word, I did not mean to suggest.
It was a trigger, sure.
Right.
Maria says it's very frustrating that the Democrats did not accept the $600 weekly unemployment benefit extension through August. Those of us who are actually suffering and on the verge of losing our cars and our homes are the ones hurting from their stubbornness out of a political stunt to hold this power until November. Harry,
well, that's interesting, Joe. I interviewed Alex Morris, who was running against Richie Neal.
Yes, sir.
Yesterday, and Morris had very early. Now, perhaps because Neal had written these bills, he wrote the CARES Act and the Heroes Act. But Morris had criticized Neal on that and said he wouldn't have voted for this very $600 that people are talking about now because it wasn't enough. Well, you know, that's interesting we hear from a person who says, I need that $600. And we have a congressional candidate who says, I wouldn't have voted for that if I were in Congress because it wasn't enough. Makes me shiver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We go to Charlie, who says, how can Republicans possibly believe that it is helpful to withhold $600 weekly from the American people and thereby force the economy into a nosedive? Have they decided that they are going to get shellacked in November anyway and concluded that their best move is to give a destroyed American economy to the Democrats to fix?
Nah, they don't know what to do. They just don't know what to do. It's that simple.
I've heard this is somewhat anecdotal because I don't have numbers in front of me, but just I've seen a number of Democrats on various cable news shows talk about their willingness to say, well, maybe 600 is too much, and giving an idea that they would settle for less. That I find somewhat surprising, especially given Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's insistence that it be that much.
Well, I mean, it's negotiable. I mean, don't you think if they got everything else or largely everything else that they could bring it down $150 or something and say that's the compromise? I mean, there's so many other expenditures in the $3 trillion bill that maybe that is, you know, that is something if everything else went through, they would negotiate on, and they'd be foolish not to in that sense if it would help.
We go to Brian, who writes, what's so sacred about landlords? If millions of people have lost their jobs and income, why can't landlords take a hit too?
Well, they are.
Bobby says, yeah. I agree with a comment regarding evictions. No address by a certain date, no vote. Everything Trump does is designed to help him.
Yes.
This is a letter on testing. Lauren says, here we are in August. We still have mostly had inadequate testing and no strategy for identifying asymptomatic cases. New York is doing better than most places, but in general, it's too hard for someone to get a test on demand, and it takes too long to get results. Until we have quick, easy testing, we are in big trouble. England is about to launch a 90-minute test for COVID and flu. Why don't we have this? JP, anything
well put.
On that?
I agree with the letter writer. If we had rapid testing and rapid results, we would be in a much better place. I took a test from the state of New York last Tuesday and got the result back yesterday. That was Sunday, so it took 6 days to get back a test that was done by the state of New York. And Governor Cuomo wrote a New York Times op-ed about how great New York was in testing. And I don't doubt his numbers. I don't doubt that the average result time is 2 to 3 days. But I would say that for people that take a test and get the results 6 days later, you might as well not take a test.
Did you have it done in Albany? In the
UAlbany, yeah.
State University, yeah. Which seems to be the main testing
site. It's all Dr. Fauci's fault.
Don't start that again, but okay.
Here we go.
All right, let's go to one more letter. This one is interesting. It's off topic, and usually we try to stay on topic, but I'll throw it in because I find it interesting. Unfortunately, according to the Courier in Louisville, McGrath is way behind McConnell, garnering only about 35% of likely voters in a poll conducted between July 24th and August 2nd. Moscow Mitch had about 53%, a margin of error, 3.5%.
Well, that's right. That's right. When I was quoting the close race, I was quoting polls from several weeks ago, and I did not know the results of this particular poll, and thank you for that.
I find it interesting about McGrath because she was really doing very well.
She was,
until
yeah.
the primary, the last, I say last minute, but it's sort of the 11th hour primary run, and then a lot of support seemed to fade, which I don't quite understand. Rosemary, do you have anything more on that?
Well, I have been blaming AOC and progressives for pushing, actually a very good candidate, except the timing was all off. Push him for another job or for the next time. Instead, he was put up as a candidate against her. And you could just see Mitch stretch and ease back and relax. And he copied every negative thing said about her. And it just made her look very weak. I think this was a case of the Democrats. And now we'll get all the letters saying, oh, it's nice and healthy to have a primary system, blah, blah, blah. It weakened her.
Blah, blah, blah.
Depending on which side of the argument you're sitting at a particular moment, there are days then primaries help you. There are days they kill you.
Mary Ellen says, how long does it take legislators to earn $600? How insensitive. They actually judge people trying to survive and want to withhold $600 a week. Unbelievable. All right, let's go to another issue if we can. And while we're talking about elections, let's talk about turnout. This is an interesting article in the Washington Post, at least I found it interesting. Hopefully you all will agree that as Trump leans into attacks on mail voting, the GOP officials are saying that they're worried that this is going to have an effect on Republican turnout, and has put them into the word that some GOP officials are using is a crisis. President Trump's unfounded attacks on mail balloting are discouraging his own supporters from embracing the practice, according to polls and Republican leaders across the country, prompting growing alarm that one of the central strategies of his campaign is threatening GOP prospects in November. Multiple public surveys show a growing divide between Democrats and Republicans about the security of voting by mail, with Republicans saying they are far less likely to trust it in November. In addition, party leaders in several states say they are encountering resistance among GOP voters who are being encouraged to vote absentee, while also seeing the president describe mail voting as rigged and fraudulent. As a result, state and local Republicans across the country fear they are falling dramatically behind in a practice that is expected to be key to voter turnout this year. Though through mailers and Facebook ads, they are racing to promote absentee balloting among their own. In the process, some Republican officials have tried to draw a distinction between absentee ballots and mail ballots. Trump claims absentee ballots are secure. He has repeatedly attacked mail ballots. The terms are typically used interchangeably, even by the president. What is there to do?
What I think is interesting about this storyline is that the president is using an election that happened just here in New York 6 weeks ago as an example of one to attack. Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney had a primary against a guy by the name of Suraj Patel. That happened 6 weeks ago, June 23rd. They still have not, certified the election. And a judge just yesterday said that they now need to count 12,000 ballots that previously were going to be thrown away. This was also a front page story on the New York Times yesterday by Jesse McKinley, saying that this example in New York, it's 6 weeks ago, and they're fighting over 12,000 thrown out ballots. Imagine that, imagine that over 12 swing states, and imagine that over, dozens of precincts and hundreds of thousands of ballots where each, judges in different places are saying, count these, don't count these. And I do think that the mail-in ballot issue is going to be something that we're going to be living with in November, and potential chaos in the weeks following the election.
Well, I would agree with you, JP. So my question to you is, what would you have us do?
I think it's a tough call. What I wish happened, I wish that New York did a good job with their mail-in ballots so that we could have provided a template for the nation of this is how it should happen. There are obviously people that are not going to want to go to the polls and shouldn't go to the polls by putting their health in danger. But I think that what has happened in New York, 6 weeks later, we still don't, we still can't figure out a congressional race with low turnout. It was a low turnout congressional race. It wasn't a high turnout like it would be in the presidential race. I think it's going to be tough. There really is no roadmap of how to make this smooth in November.
I have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, do our last round with our wonderful panel, and we welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel. Again, our email address, if you wish to write to us, is panel@wamc.org. Our panelists this morning, Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and J.P. Miller. All right, let's go to another topic we would like to talk about, the very big story, which is that the Office of the Attorney General, the Office of the District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., made a disclosure in a new court filing arguing Mr. Trump's accountants turn over his tax returns that they are investigating his company over fraud, is what that filing suggests. That it has been investigating President Trump and his company for possible bank and insurance fraud, a significantly broader inquiry than the prosecutors have acknowledged in the past. The suggestion by the Office of the District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, came in a new federal and court filing arguing that Mr. Trump's accountants should have to comply with a grand jury subpoena seeking 8 years of his personal and corporate tax returns. Mr. Trump has asked a judge to declare the subpoena invalid. That from the New York Times. Alan.
Well, it's interesting because clearly Cy Vance has had some reversals in his popularity as district attorney. And he's brought in a former, I believe, solicitor general to be the voice in this particular case. And what we see here is that he felt he was on shaky ground building his whole case around the Trump affairs with the porn star and all the rest.
Right.
So I think what happened here is that by saying no, we've been interested in a lot more than that, they expand the importance of the case, and they give the judge something to work with in terms of his ruling or her ruling.
Rosemary.
Well, I think that the Vance has taken advantage of the immense public reporting done on fraud in that company, including systematic going on for decades, starting with the father, tax evasion, the frauds, of course, with the hush payments and other payments going out, the setting up of the company that Michael Cohen testified to, Michael Cohen's testimony, which implicated Trump in front of Congress. All of that is now part of the public record. So I didn't see it as, I mean, you may be right, but I did not see it as a failing, as a shoring up a weakness in his case that he pointed all this out. He gave the judge a lot of information saying this is open to areas of examination. And I'm just so pleased that someone is doing it, because why isn't it the Southern District of New York? Everyone is saying we don't know if they really shut it down, but it certainly seems that they have not done anything since Cohen went to jail to further that case. And and we know that Barr has been messing with the Southern District, but at least now Manhattan is looking into those same issues. So good.
I have a question for Mike Spain. I want your overall thoughts on this issue, of course, Mike. But in addition to that, the use of the word suggestion, filing suggests, the district attorney's office suggested, they did it, right? I mean, I guess I don't quite get the use of the word suggest.
Yeah, that is a little bit sheepish to use that in journalism. It's like saying somebody indicated something. You know, you want to use more precise language. But clearly, it's he's alluding to, without giving all the facts, to what Alan and Rosemary spoke about, that it's more than just an investigation of a couple of alleged hush money payments to a couple of people who allegedly had affairs with Trump while he was before he was a candidate for president, et cetera. And by suggesting, using quotes around the word, that it is broader, I think it has backfired on Trump, because now that's all we're going to know about before this thing ever gets resolved. As Alan has pointed out many times, this, even if Vance does succeed and he gets these records, it's not going to become public anytime soon, unless there's a leak. And unless it's used, unless these tax records are used in a criminal prosecution, they probably won't become public for a long, long time. So long after the election, and by playing this card, which Vance is pretty, you know, political, no question, by playing this card and suggesting it's a broader inquiry based on news media reports, throwing a little bit of a bouquet to all the public domain information that he's referring to, which has been reported by the New York Times and others, that he just puts a deeper shroud on this, and it basically puts a cloud over this, makes it seem more significant than just some women who are claiming affairs with Trump and he was trying to cover it up. People don't have a taste for that, but they, now that it's his whole Trump organization that's under a cloud, it's going to hurt him. I mean, it's just one more thing that's going to hurt him a lot.
JP.
Joe, I too was, puzzled by the word using suggests. And I'm reading the news this morning early, and it was on the front page of the Times, but it wasn't the top banner. And you would think that this would be the top banner big news of the day. And for some reason, because it was in that filing saying suggesting, it was not that it's not big news, but it just wasn't a massive bombshell news story. I also found it interesting that yesterday there was a news story. I don't know if it's related, but I thought that the timing was interesting, that Deutsche Bank launched an internal review into the personal banker for President Trump and his son-in-law, mm-hmm. Jared Kushner. That was also in the New York Times. And I thought the timing was interesting there, and that the two might, I don't know that the two are connected, but I thought it was very coincidental timing.
Well, what does it suggest to you?
JP.
What do you mean?
Well, in other words, you say you thought it was interesting, but what does it suggest? Deutsche Bank, we know, is the bank that does business with Trump, and when nobody else would. Now they're doing an internal review. So I would ask you, and now that you have, you correctly bring it up, what you think it might portend? That
The headline today is Trump Organization filing suggests Trump Organization under investigation for, quote, insurance and bank fraud. And just yesterday, Deutsche Bank came out and said that they're looking into Rosemary Vrablic and two of her coworkers regarding a 2013 purchase of an approximately $1.5 million apartment in New York City's Park Avenue.
I don't know that it suggested, but
I thought it was a coincidence to have those two stories. Maybe that is what Cy Vance is looking at.
Is Deutsche Bank, are those two people you just mentioned Deutsche Bank people? I didn't get that. Yes, okay.
Yes, they're the insiders in Deutsche Bank who helped Jared and Trump to get loans at a time when they were thought to be someone you don't want to loan money to. Regular bankers would not have loaned money to them, and she pushed them. She figured in the stories done by the New York Times on Trump finances. And so the suggestion, the answer to your question, Alan, is that it looks like if there was wrongdoing, if there was a bank fraud by the Trump administration, the insider who would have helped it would be this Rosemary woman.
And so one wonders, right, the good Rosemary, you.
Yeah. The good Rosemary woman.
One wonders whether the hounds are at the door, to mix metaphors. In other words, Deutsche Bank, you can see these guys sitting around, or people sitting around, I should say, and talking to each other and saying, we better do something now because it looks like this whole thing might unravel.
Well, this stuff goes on all the time at banks all over the world. But if Vance keeps the pressure on, if this proceeds against Trump, there'll be huge pressure on Deutsche Bank. And so, yes, they definitely will want to blame one or two people inside their organization rather than their whole way of doing business, which is exactly what should be indicted.
Mike,
you are.
Oh, no, I just think it's obvious that Deutsche Bank sees a lot of potential risk here, and they're trying to look like they're doing the right thing, and perhaps this is the right thing to do, if they find that people within their organization have been steering loans to Trump in exchange for favorable condo purchases, et cetera, et cetera. And they had a bad reputation already, and they were having trouble staying because regulators were going after them. They had trouble even finding people to lend money to in Manhattan. They really wanted to be in that Manhattan real estate business, and along comes a guy who no one is lending money to. It was a marriage made in heaven. And now they probably see Trump going down, and better distance ourselves now and do the right thing and hire an outside person to come in and look at it, blah, blah, blah.
We have a couple of letters on voting that I'd like to get to in our last 3 or 4 minutes together. Corinne says, pay the unemployed $20 an hour to count ballots and it'll get done. Richard says, here's my proposal. Make the general election day a federal holiday. Strongly request that people go to the polls in some type of alphabetized order, like folks with last names A through E voting from 7 to 9 all day long to create shorter wait times. Make sure the USPS have all of the people and resources they need. I want our government to make this a top priority right now.
I know the writer means well, but as it is, you know, for those of us who have jobs and who have to in Albany and have to get back to Great Barrington to,
right,
you know, to vote. And it's tough, and I do it. But I have to say, if now you tell me the only time I can vote is between 7 and 9 because
right,
my name starts with C, it does raise certain questions.
It's another obstacle.
And it's an indoor venue. You know, it's in like an elementary school gym, and there are, you know, 25 people packed in there. It's just, it's when I envision my experience is voting, it is not a socially distanced exercise, and it is a crowded exercise, and everybody's trying to get there on one day, and it's a chaotic day anyway, let alone without the pandemic going on. There has to be some way to get these ballots counted by mail, but in a way that it's not going to be exploited after Election Day with recounts and challenges and all that stuff.
Yeah,
you know, I have a
theory. Problem is that we're 3 months away. There's no time to do that.
Yeah.
Trump ends up being right if for the wrong reason. The system could be
because
rigged and
happen.
Open to fraud. If we were to go ahead now with e-balloting, without the systems, the resources, the training to do the counting, oh my gosh, it's how can we do all of that in 3 months in 50 states?
Mike, go ahead.
But there are states that have very successfully had mail-in voting for years, like Washington State. There is a template. It doesn't have to be the Manhattan template that got botched during the primary back in June. I mean, there are plenty of places where it's done well, and it works, and democracy thrives. Utah, I think, is another state that does it pretty much widespread, and it's not a bad thing. I just have a very brief conspiracy theory about this.
Oh, good.
Trump is heading down in the polls. We all know that. And, you know, he might pull it off because he's done things like that before. But he's making sure that if he does not win on Election Day, he sullies the victory for the victor and casts doubt about the legitimacy of the next administration coming in. And then, you know, then he can just fall back on his 2016 plan until he accidentally won. And that was to, you know, start a Trump network, you know, that would be like Breitbart and Fox combined and make himself millions off of going after the crippled government that he's handing over to the next guy that comes along.
These are the days where there's a fine line between conspiracy theory and reality.
Yeah, I know.
Peter,
yeah,
Wright,
that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. Peter writes to us and says, if those that can, and it should be most, simply deliver their ballots to their town hall, would that be legal, and would that mitigate some mail service issues? Could secure boxes at polling locations be created for the same purpose in larger communities? A question asked by Peter. Joseph, in our final
the
moment.
The safe boxes are under.
Okay, go ahead.
They're under attack by the Trump campaign in states like Alabama, where they put in the safe boxes. Just like you say, you just go and you just drop your ballot into a place and you don't have to, you know, go to a polling place. The campaign is saying that, no, this is not fair. It's not safe enough. And they're trying to stop it. So
we will end there. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, JP Miller, thank you so much for being with us. We will be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.